After you get your songbooks marked there, you would turn over to Proverbs, the seventh proverb. Want to study out of that passage tonight. As I said earlier, it's good to see everybody out. And we hope that you'll open your Bible, study along with us. As you read through this part of this proverb here, it's told us a story. And it's told, in fact, a number of times in Proverbs, Solomon mentions things about adultery. In chapter 2, chapter 5, chapter 6, chapter 7, chapter 22. And that's a theme that keeps on coming back to. And as I studied through this, I was wondering, and we don't know as far as when Solomon wrote this. We don't know if he was a young king at that point or if he was the old king by that point. And it's really interesting to me that he would be one to write about this when he had 700 wives and 300 concubines, but yet he's one that addresses this subject. And he's talking here about sexual sins, about sexual immorality, as my New King James often talks about it, use that phrase. And we have to realize that even though he's talking about it in one specific way here, that really applies in other ways too. In other words, he's talking about a young man who's simple and naive, and then he talks about it from the point of view of a crafty woman. And yet, the roles could be reversed. It could be that the young lady is actually the one that is simple, and could be that the man is the one that's crafty. And also, a lot of times we read through the Bible, we find the words sexual immorality or fornication is used. And then the word adultery is used. And we realize that adultery is a specific type of fornication. And that fornication is the big tent word, means all sexual sins. Where adultery tends to be a specific one. And that is somebody's married. However, let's keep in mind also the principle that both of them are sin. And even if this woman in this parable had been single herself, it will not change really the focus of this parable. Throughout the Bible, God warns and condemns us about sexual immorality. And you start all the way from Exodus, the 20th chapter, verse 14, where it says, you shall not commit adultery. And you go on through the Old Testament, you find the warnings given a lot of times that God points out through the prophets that he was seeing the immoral conduct of his children. And he would mention specific things he talked about. And then also we go on New Testament, it's stressed again to us in many ways. And I thought about Hebrews 13, verse 4. Marriage will be honorable among all, and the bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge. And then between, and as you go on through the Bible, there's many other passages that talks about it. In Romans, in 1 Corinthians, excuse me, in the 6th chapter, then when Paul writes them, he said, do you not know the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? And then he starts off in a list of sins, and it's interesting to me that fornication, adultery, homosexuality, sodomites, and probably idolaters were put in this because that was a common activity they were involved in their temples. In Romans 1st chapter, when God points out the sins of the Gentiles, you go through that list of sins, and one of those, again, is sexual immorality. As you go on, we find, well, in Revelation 21st chapter, when he's talking about those who be lost, the second death that he talks about there, he said, and among the sins again it's mentioned there is sexual immorality. And so the reason is because this is a prevalent sin. It's not one confined just our society. As we talk about this, we have to realize it's always been a problem, and we have to keep our guard up against this. But Solomon, as he addresses this, does it from a point of view of looking out his window. Now again, as I read through this and trying to decide whether or not Solomon literally was looking out the window and saw this, or he's trying to give instructions, so he comes up with a story, probably the first, not the latter. But when he looks out, he says, for at my window of my house, I looked through the lattice and saw among the simple, I perceived among the youths a young man devoid of understanding. And we could probably visualize that in some ways or another. Here's the wise king, whether in his office or at just simply his residence, looking out, and he's observing different activities, and see this young man. And as he talks about this, you notice that he describes this young man as being simple. Out of lacking understanding, we would say naive, maybe another word there. He's not using the word, by the way, stupid. But he sees a young man that does not have the experience, does not understand everything that's going on. And in a lot of ways, in fact, all of us at one time have been naive. And maybe about different things, but as we were born to the world, as we grow up, there's a lot of things we don't know. A lot of things we don't understand. However, through life's experiences, we learn the lesson. And so when he looks at this young man, again, he lacks the knowledge, really, to understand what's going to happen with this temptation. And as he talks about the young man, he points out that he needs to listen. And really, the writing of this here is for our instruction. But as I think about this young man, again, he would have been a Jew. And he would have been one that had received the instructions of the law. He would have known of sins of adultery and sexual immorality. This probably was not something new to his experience in life as far as knowledge about this. But a lot of times, naive people or young people, that they have to experience things to learn for themselves. Now, again, when we're talking about the young right here, I believe that this not, again, confined just to them. This also applies to older people also. And that is, he looks at it, and this young man had probably been taught this, but, you know, sometimes, again, we just have to experience it. I've termed this, my way of expressing this is the wet paint syndrome. And that is, going one time, Regina and I was in a big office building, the elevator, we walked in, and on the wall was the saying, with a sign that said, "Do not touch wet paint." And this was like the first floor. We had to go about three or four floors before we got off. So every floor, somebody else got on the elevator. And I noticed those two reactions people had. One reaction was wet paint. I wonder if it's really wet. And they go in there and they touch it. And the other experience was people look at that and say, "Wet paint. Yeah, I better stay away from it." There's a lot of wet paint people where they have to experience, they have to touch it to find out whether it's right or not. And so this young man would have been that. He would have had the warnings. He would have had the teaching of the law to know this was wrong. Again, I believe that describes a lot of people today, even among Christians. And I put up here, we have to learn from the mistakes of others, or we are doomed to make them ourselves. We have different ways of learning. One is by hearing, by acknowledging, by thinking about what somebody says to us. And another is by experience itself. And so this young man, he looks around, and again, the things talked about in this passage are really common. In fact, as far as the naive and the simple, I thought about back in the 1960s. And I was still a youth at that point, a young man. My brother being 5 years older is a little bit more than his generation. But in 1960, they had this thing called the sexual revolution. And that is all of a sudden you had birth control pills, so the fear of pregnancy was gone in a lot of ways. Not necessarily the fear of sexually transmitted diseases, but one of the things that kept people from committing adultery is the fact that they may get pregnant, so they stayed away from it because of that. Now, again, I'm not saying before 1960 everybody was living pure lives. I realize it still went on. But it became much more prevalent during that time period. And people were advocating free love and the idea of old values of morality, of purity were old-fashioned, and we just need to cast those things off. At the same time, you had the introduction of drugs. And again, the idea of turn on and tune out became one of the phrases of that time period. And drugs such as marijuana started, but also other drugs of heroin, morphine, and cocaine, other kind of drugs became much more prevalent. And again, people were warned about those things, but a lot of people had the experience. They had to go through it. And then also you had the phrase kind of summed up the attitude of that generation when somebody said, "Don't trust anyone over 30. And that is, everybody's older than you. You know, that's the old generation. And you just can't rely upon what they say. It's really the phrase right there. And so they want to experience everything. They were like this here, the naive and the simple. And one thing that they did not talk about was God's Word. They never looked at God's Word, it seems like. So when the psalmist looks out, he sees this young man. And these are often mistakes people make. And again, not just young people, but older people also. But in that time preaching of being in various places, we've had members to have committed this sin. And he realizes it's not just restricted to one age group. And so the first thing he talks about is this young man was in a place he should not have been. If you look at verse 8 and verse 9, he said, pass along the street near her corner, and he took the path to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. A time before street lights were common, or didn't have them back then today. But notice there where he's at, and that is at a street corner near her house. In other words, he's at the wrong place. There are places we go to that we know before we ever get there, there's danger. A person sees a casino. They have a sign up there talking about gambling and free food and trying to entice you to come in. You know ahead of time what they're trying to do. And they're trying to get you to come inside. And don't be surprised if you go inside, something bad happens. And because you see, again, where we're at physically a lot of times shows where we're at spiritually also. When you think about Peter as denying the Lord Jesus, when Jesus tells him he's going to deny him three times before the night's over, then Peter said, no, not me. But you look in Luke, the 22nd chapter, start verse 54, and having arrested him, that is, having Jesus being arrested, they led him and brought him into the high priest's house. But Peter followed at a distance. Now, when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them. And a certain servant girl, seeing him as he sat by the fire, looked intently at him, said, this man was also with him. But he denied him, saying, woman, I do not know him. And after a little while, another saw him and said, you also are one of them. And he said, man, I'm not. It's been observed that part of Peter's problem was where he was at, physically. Because he has separated himself from Jesus, and he's actually surrounded himself with people that were on the opposite side, if you would. And so we have to think about where we go. And so Psalm here describes it, not just a street corner near her house, but also in darkness. You know, the twilight there, and the evening, and dark night. He said there are certain sins that are more prevalent at night than in the day. And perhaps because people think, well, no, because it is nighttime, people won't see me do this, or nobody's going to observe me doing this, and they feel safer at nighttime in committing sins than they do in the daytime. The Apostle Paul, in writing Church of Thessalonica, in the 5th chapter, 1 Thessalonians, he talks about the end when Christ comes back, and he's pointing out the ways of the world versus the way of the Christian, as far as realization of good and bad. And in verse 7, he makes this comparison. He talks about it like this. Says, for those who sleep, sleep at night, and those who get drunk are drunk at night. And trying to make the emphasis that the Gentiles out there, they're not considering God's word, and they're going out partying it up. He said, that this is what they're doing at nighttime. And so when we think about the night here, it's a time where a lot of times temptations do come across. When things happen, as Luke, one person said, nothing good happens in a bar after midnight. I think that was a coach that actually used that phrase or said that when one's players got in trouble. We could actually say, well, nothing good happens in a bar. We go in there, you're in a bad place. And when it's after midnight, you're at a bad place at a bad time. Be aware of your circumstance. Be aware of where you are, in other words. And again, as he's talking about this idea of immorality, of adultery, just realize that there are bad places to be. And Regina, again, there's been various places we've had been at and people got involved in adultery. And one of the things that I've noticed as a common pattern of that is that they were in the wrong place. Whether as a young man decided to have a Bible study with a co-worker at work and she happens to be a woman, and they start to come together and studying by themselves at lunch break, and then decide maybe after a while to actually meet after work and have a Bible study at that time, just the two of them. And I'm not saying it's wrong, period, to ever study with somebody privately, but I'm saying you have to be aware of the circumstances you're placing yourself into. Don't be naive. Don't think that you cannot be tempted by somebody else. Don't think that maybe you will not after a while start thinking of that person differently than what you do beforehand. And so he talks about this as far as at nighttime. And so that's the first point. Be aware of where you're at. Stay away from the wrong places. And then he goes on and he points out her enticing, seductive nature of this woman. As you go on in our passage, verse 10, it said, there a woman met him with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart. And really those things two go together. And as our clothes say something about us, our clothes really reveal something about how we think and how we act towards people, our attitudes. And not only that, but also she was loud and rebellious. Her feet would not stay at home. At times she was outside, at times in the open square, lurking at every corner. In other words, she's on the prowl. Today, the phrase cougar is used a lot of times. And she would have been a cougar at that time, if you're how at least I read this. Here she's an older woman, more experienced woman, and she's wanting a young man. And so she's looking. And so she called him and kissed him with an impudent face and said to him, I have peace offerings with me. Today I have paid my vow, so I came out to meet you, diligently to seek your face. And I found you, I have spread my bed of tapestry, colored coverings of Egyptian linen. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. And what she's doing is she's going around here and she is trying to entice him, seduce him. Seduction is really to make something attractive, to point out the attractive nature of something, to tempt somebody. And I believe as we read through this here, we see she's doing exactly that. And she uses her words to do that. Not just her manner of dress, although that's part of it, but she uses her words. And also how she talks about how much she, what she can offer him. And then only that, Proverbs 22 verse 14 said, the mouth of an immoral woman is a deep pit. He is abhorred by the Lord will fall there. And so we have to be careful about what people are saying to us, about how they try again to seduce us. Her attire is mentioned as the clothes of a harlot. The Bible really never describes exactly what that is, does it? When you read New Testament, talk about modesty, it really doesn't give us exact limits on modesty. What exactly is modest? We understand there's something that's modest, there's something that's immodest. There's some things that are too revealing, there's some things that may be too tight, there's some things too short. And so this kind of attire, though, that Solomon describes as a harlot. What we wear advertises who we are and what we want to do. Now, if I would say somebody, saw somebody in town the other day, and she was on a street corner, she was dressed like a prostitute, you would know, I wouldn't have to describe anything else, would I? You would have a mental image of that. And so that's the way this woman was dressed. And then she's unrelenting. She's diligent, is the word used in our passage. It's not a case where she says, oh, well, there's nobody out here, and I'll just go back home. She's on the prowl again. She's looking around for somebody. And so she's not going to give up, especially once he shows up. Then it really becomes much more diligent on her part. Again, we have a person in the wrong place. And we have a person trying to entice him to do the wrong thing. It reminds me of a passage in 2 Timothy 2, verse 22, when he says, flee also youthful lust, but pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart. That the inspired writer says, the way to handle that, first of all, get out of there. Whatever is going on, get away from it. Flee youthful lust, in particular what he mentions here. Dan Simmons said that seduction was both a science and an art, a blend of skill, discipline, proximity, and opportunity. Mostly proximity. I put proximity and opportunity here really together. They are so closely related. But what he's saying is somebody close. Somebody is near. You have to be careful. That's where seduction occurs. And notice again that some people know what they're doing and how to seduce somebody else. Another person says seduction brings forth death. Now, of course, we don't understand that because Romans 6 verse 23 said the wages of sin is death. And so we look here at her enticing nature as what she's going through. And then Solomon points out some of the things she's saying. And that is what she's promising this young man is the reward or the pleasure without seeing the cost. Then you look at this passage, verse 18. And there it says, come, let's take our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with love. For my husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey.
He has taken a bag of money with him and will come on the appointed day. With her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Immediately he went after her as an ox go to the slaughter or as a fool to the correction of the stocks. And then what she's doing here is she's saying, there's no commitment here. There's no consequences here. She's saying we can have this relationship and nobody, there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing, no problem with it. And again, that's the way a lot of times people fall prey to this, and that is there are certain things in common. When you talk about immorality today, somebody would say, what's wrong with it? What's wrong with maybe two single people living together? What's wrong with somebody's not happy in marriage, having somebody else on the side? What's wrong with those kind of situations? Well, look around your eyes. A lot of times, you have a willing partner. She is more than willing here. She's the one actually doing seducing. But you have a willing partner there, and not only that, but also you have no strings attached. There's nothing in this about really loving each other or leaving her husband or anything like that. I mean, this would be, and it really describes the one-night stand, doesn't it? And so here's no commitment at all. And not only that, but also she says, no one will know. And especially her husband. Notice what she says about her husband. He's on a long journey. He's far away from home. He doesn't know what's happening here. He's taking a lot of money. And so he's going to be gone for a long time. And I know when he's coming back. And he ain't coming back right now. Again, he's not going to know. The fact is, though, that when you think about no one will know, a lot more people know than what others realize when something like this is going on. And I thought about King David and Bathsheba. Now, I'm not saying Bathsheba was like the crafty woman, but when you look at it, somebody here who is spiritually minded as far as David. And David is in the wrong place. Now, he's at Jerusalem. His men, his army are off to do battle. He's in Jerusalem, and he looks out there and sees a woman on her rooftop, and she's bathing. She's naked. And again, there's no indication he twists her arm to come and to see him. But you look at that reading there in 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, you find out that when it's over with, he sends her back home and apparently thinking that nobody's going to know. Really? I mean, all the people inside the palace, nobody, the one that went to get her, bring her to David, wouldn't know anything. His servants wouldn't know anything. Sure, they would know. But what we found out also is that the danger, as she wound up being pregnant, he realized, well, the husband's going to know then. And so we have here that going on. But also, there's no talk here about the fact that the Lord knows. Even if nobody else found out, even if her husband never heard or never learned about this, the one person I mentioned here is that God knows. In fact, she kind of cloaks an idea of being religious when she says, talks about the fact that basically that what she has done earlier. And so you go on in Proverbs 6 verse 27, again, one of the passages Solomon writes about this going on. And he said, can a man take fire to his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be seared? So as he goes to his neighbor's wife, whoever touches her shall not be innocent. Of course, rhetorical questions here. Of course, if you take fire and put inside your coat, inside your clothes, you're going to be burned by it. And there's no way to escape that. Can one walk on hot coals and not be burned? If you walk on hot coals, your feet are going to be burned. That's just a fact of it. And so he said, that's also the way to go to your neighbor's wife. There will be consequences. There's going to be things that are going to happen. And you may not realize, you may not like think about that, but they will happen even if you think it's okay. While I was growing up, there was, for the benefit of our younger members here, there's Dear Abby and Ann Landers. And they were two advice columnists in paper. One of them tended to run in, when they had papers in the morning and papers in the afternoon. One ran in the morning, one ran in the afternoon. And people write in with all kinds of problems, and Dear Abby and Ann Landers would talk about the problems and tell them how to solve the problems. Well, they're gone now, but one had a daughter by the name of Amy. And Amy has an advice column. I just so happened to notice the other day on Yahoo News that she has somebody wrote into her. And this woman said that her husband had gotten injured on a job, was in the hospital. And one of his co-workers called her up and offered to take her out to dinner. And then as they're out to dinner, they start drinking, and then before you know it, they commit adultery. And that's kind of how she said it. Now you stop thinking about that. Every decision she made right there was wrong. Going out with somebody as a spouse by yourself is not a good idea. Drinking while you're out together by yourself is not a good idea. And this woman, while she was writing, the reason why she was writing in was because she had a guilty conscience, but the reason she's writing in is because she was now pregnant. And she knew that baby wasn't her husband, but was the other guy's. And you start thinking about that. What's going to happen? And Amy basically said, you got to tell him the truth, and it'll probably be the end of your marriage. And that's right. Those are some things happen. That's what Psalm is trying to talk about. There's things that's going to happen that you will not be able to escape with a sin. And then he goes on. He shows us the end result also. And that is, he says, verse 23, he goes following after her and says, till an arrow struck his liver. As a bird hastens to a snare, he did not know it would cost his life. Now therefore listen to me, my children. Pay attention to the words of my mouth. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not strain her paths, for she has cast out many wounded, and all who were slain by her were strong men. Her house is the way to hell, descending to the chambers of death. And so he describes, here's what I'm going to tell you what's going to happen to you. And when he describes a young man, he talks about what? Like being a poor animal, about ready to be slaughtered. I couldn't help but think about when we used to have cows on the farm. And there would come that time period when it was time to send them off to the market. On the truck, and they're going to be taken to be slaughtered. And for some reason, those cows knew when there was a truck in the barn pen to run, to get out of there. However, the one thing that we knew would work is take a bucket of corn out there and start calling them. Just walk out to them and have one of them actually put her head in there and start eating. And once she had that first bite, she would want more. And the others would see the same thing. And after a while, just start walking towards the barn. And then all those cows would follow right along with their calves. What happened? Well, again, all of a sudden the fear was gone. But what was happening is they were walking towards their death. Any of you been farmers or been hunters? I don't know if we have any really avid hunters in this group here, but we've been to certain places where, I mean, we had deer hunters that was so committed, and they would go out and spend all night in the tree stand and be ready in the morning. And those people, and the deer never had any idea what's going to happen to them. And so that's why he describes this young man. It's like that animal about ready to be slaughtered. He has no idea what's going on. In James' first chapter, maybe kind of a parallel passage, if you would. Because there in verse 13 says, let no one say we are tempted by God. In other words, when you do something and you're tempted, don't say God's the reason, or I blame God because I do this, or because I have that that appeals me. It's all God's fault. So no, don't say that. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. The temptation doesn't come from God. But each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. It's your temptations. You're the ones that have to handle that temptation, whatever it may be. And it goes on, then when desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin, when it's full grown, brings forth death. And same result here talked about in Proverbs, the 7th chapter, and that is, yeah, I'll tell you what the end result of your action is. So that is, it's going to cost you your life, young man. Again, he's naive. He doesn't understand. He hasn't had to experience it. But James tells the same thing, that when we give in sin, then it brings about death, spiritual death, separation from God. And a lot of times, again, people just don't think about the consequences of their actions. There was a song by TLC a number of years ago talking about waterfalls. Don't go chasing waterfalls, may have been the title of it. And one part of that was talking about the young man that woke up one day and did not recognize his own face in the mirror. And he's talking about AIDS. He's talking about the result of that from his activity. Again, I remember when people laughed about AIDS. I remember when one of the jokes was, what's the greatest danger of getting AIDS? Is convince your mother you're Haitian. Because at first that's what they talk about. It's just people from Haiti that had AIDS. And then they start saying, it became much more than a joke, didn't it? It's a terrible thing to have. So he looked at this and he says to us that in the end she is bitter as a wormwood, sharp as two-edged sword. Her feet go down to hell, her steps lay ahead to death, her steps lay hold of hell. That's how Solomon describes her in the way that she's trying to tempt you to go in. As I was reading this, and there's always the implication to all of us as far as making sure we stay in the right place, we don't get ourselves in the wrong place, we don't allow somebody to tempt us, that realize there's consequences to our actions and we're not told a full thing. See the big picture, see what the spiritual result of things are. But I got to think about this, how this applies to other sins also. In other words, you think about, and I'm just going to give one example, drugs. I have drugs, stealing, lying, just put all kind of other sins right down there. And you realize that really the same process is used a lot of time. In other words, with drugs, you have perhaps a person that's naive. It's not that they haven't heard about the danger of drugs, whether we're talking about alcohol, we're talking about some other kind of drug that's illegal or not. However, they're naive and they don't really think about the danger of that drug. And then not only that, but also they hear the warnings, but they oftentimes think, well, these warnings, that they're trying to prevent me from having fun. They're over exaggerating the death. That may happen to somebody else, but it won't happen to me. Again, they're naive. And then after that, they think about it, they go to the wrong place. There are certain places. Now I will tell you that if you go there, nothing good is going to happen. Whether it is a party where everybody's drinking, or whether it is a place where there's rapid use of drugs, and maybe the place on the street corner where the addicts are. You go to those places, bad things are going to happen if you hang around them. And then only then, but also they're enticed. Maybe it's the idea, the enticement again, is that you'll feel so much better. Yeah, you can escape the tension of this world. You have a little time, a little bit of holiday, and not only that, but also it'll make you wake and relax, and you'll really have a good time then. Isn't that what really the beer commercials offer most of the time? The idea that you'll have plenty of friends, that you'll have a good time, and again, there's no consequences to drinking. The drug user that says one of these will make you feel a lot better. And then they don't tell you about the end result of that. We've all seen the pictures of people, meth addicts. And the before and after picture of those here, where maybe beforehand is a pretty young lady and after is that she looks like she's 50 years old and dying any day. And just think about that. Why did they get involved in it? Well, they thought it was going to be fun. They thought it was going to be good for them. So they're enticed. And they're promised again that reward without any consequences of it. Nobody's going to know. You don't have to tell anybody else about this. But other people will find out. Other people aren't dumb. They can figure things out too. And then finally, the end result is going to be death. I have a cousin right now. She's quite a bit younger than I am. I guess she's my second cousin, to tell you the truth, because her mother is a little bit younger than I am too. But my cousin has been in jail and out of jail for the last 5 or 6 years. She's had a couple of children that she no longer has the opportunity to raise because of her criminal record. And every time they release her out of jail and send her to the rehab, she goes right back to the drug once she gets out. And I would not be surprised any time to receive a phone call saying that young lady is dead. It would not surprise me a bit, because that's the result of what she's doing. She's killing herself. But the same thing be said again about stealing, lying, and many other activities people get involved in. And so as I look at Proverbs 7 chapter, almost said, and I'm not saying that Solomon wrote it as an allegory. I think he's talking about specific sin there, but I see that really as a, we can apply that as an allegory to other sins. And we have to be aware of it and stay away from it. I do appreciate your attention tonight. We have the song selected, 287, there's a fountain free. If tonight anybody needs to obey the gospel of Christ, we're here to aid you. Why don't you let us know as we stand as we sing.